All right. Good evening, everyone. Welcome.
Welcome.
Nice, intimate group. Topic for tonight is the path is the goal, which happens to be the title of one of Trigger Trungpa's books. And this is an excellent book. It's from his earlier teachings, so he's teaching in a very kind of outrageous style. Very outrageous. Really challenging people and not necessarily answering their questions, putting them back on them, but very playful and very intense and quite something. So this statement, the path is the goal, to me, is the essence or the statement of contemplative practice. So contemplative practice is anything you do which is based upon meditation practice. That's contemplative practice. So there could be contemplative practice. So there's running and then there's contemplative running. Like the Sakyong just wrote a book about running with a mind of meditation. Before that, you know, maybe some people did, but probably most people didn't run with the mind of meditation. But now there's a teaching on it. So now there's actually contemplative running. And actually, this is one of the brilliances of our tradition, our American Shambhala Buddhist tradition, which is that there are all these amazing numbers of disciplines that have been transformed into contemplative traditions. So like photography is now transformed into what's called miksan. And that's a contemplative photography because there were teachings given by Chögyam Trungpa on how to bring it to the path, how to actually make it into a contemplative path. And then, of course, because Lady Diana, his wife, was a very renowned dressage master, dressage was taught as a contemplative Shambhala practice. And then we have Kyudo, which is Zen archery, which is a contemplative practice. And then we have Ikebana, which is flower arranging, particularly from the Japanese tradition, which is contemplative. And we have, there's a lot of them. There are a lot of them. Then we have
tea.
Oh, cha, right, chanayu, which is tea practice from the Japanese tradition. And we also have elocution practice, which is one of my favorites. We actually have contemplative elocution practice. So, you know, I could go on. I mean, there are others. I'm trying to think what else there. Did you think of other things? Of course, there's
calligraphy
practice, yes.
Is there music?
Oh, yeah. Majorly, yeah. There isn't a name for it in Shambhala, but as a contemplative practice, but it's a part of one of our practices. Is. And of course, we have walking practice, which is walking meditation, so we have contemplative walking. But in truth, if you're a meditator and you bring your practice to whatever you do, that then could potentially become a contemplative practice. So this is a very potent thing about what we're doing here, that we could transform any activity into practice, into the path. Now, what makes this a statement of contemplative, the path is the goal, as opposed to a conventional statement of the path and the goal? You know, what's different about it in the contemplative sense? What really differentiates contemplative practice is that the focus of what we're doing is completely based, not based upon the outcome or the product. Like we may be painting, painting of course is one of them. We may be, riding a horse. And of course we have goals in our mind. We'd like to achieve something. But what makes it a practice is that you, really your focus, your entire focus is upon what you are doing in the moment. Not upon the outcome or what we're trying to produce at the end. That is your entire focus. So therefore, it removes the kind of ambition element from the formula there. So rather than this being about, you know, I'm going to get from here to there, and that's the most important thing, instead of that, the most important thing is, I am here doing this, and I'm doing it fully, 100%. And then, you know, when you do that 100%, the outcome, what you thought was your outcome that you wanted, might change, which is an interesting thing about contemplative practice, that we usually have these very fixed goals. And the problem there is that, you know, you might get to that goal, but then because you have so much ambition, you have to create another goal. So that goal is not actually very meaningful, ultimately. It's a very relative thing. And we kind of know that, but we keep creating goals for ourselves so that we can motivate ourselves. We tend to motivate ourselves by goals. So contemplative practice is kind of a whole different way to approach activity and a whole different way to embody our actions, that we're not so much embodying them with the intention of achieving something special. Rather, our intention is to arrive genuinely in that action, in that activity, to find out what is really going on here, to really connect fully with what we're doing. And then that's called wakefulness. So we could say that our goal is wakefulness, which is true, but how we arrive at that goal is really to go beyond the goal, the notion of a goal. So that's, you know, one of my favorite sayings from Suzuki Roshi is, if it isn't a paradox, it isn't true. So that's one of the paradoxes is, you know, we have a goal, but then we have to let go of the goal in order to actually properly arrive there at all. So I thought I'd do a couple of very brief readings that are connected with this topic. One is from one of my very favorite books on meditation practice, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And this is written by Shunryu Suzuki, who was the first really Western Zen master. I mean, he came to the West and he had Western students. And this was around the time Trigam Trungpa came to the West, a little after him. But he was a remarkable teacher. And they were friends, actually, Trigam Trungpa and Suzuki Roshi. So here he's talking about posture, and he's talking about the form of meditation, or right practice. I'm jumping into the middle here. If you want true understanding of Buddhism, you should practice in this way. These forms are not a means of obtaining the right state of mind. To take this posture itself is the purpose of our practice. When you have this posture, you have the right state of mind. So there is no need to try to attain some special state. When you try to attain something, your mind starts to wander about somewhere else. When you do not try to attain something, anything, you have your own body and mind right here. A Zen master would say, kill the Buddha. Kill the Buddha if the Buddha exists somewhere else. Kill the Buddha because you should resume your own Buddha nature. Doing something is expressing our own nature. We do not exist for the sake of something else. This is the fundamental teaching expressed in the forms that we observe. So, that used to be one of my favorite things to remind myself of when I'm practicing. I'm sitting there, I'm going, you know, well, is this it? I go, oh yeah, I'm in the posture, this is it. I've taken the posture, I am the Buddha, that's it, there is nothing else. And then you just breathe, and you just follow it, and it's extraordinarily simple if you view it that way. And in a way, you know, that's what we're being taught in Shambhala training as well, that really, you already possess basic goodness, there's nowhere to find it, you don't have to go looking for it, and by simplifying and just taking this posture and doing this practice, you might discover that you have possessed basic goodness. That's already there, Buddha nature.
That phrase from what you read, resuming in Buddha Nature, the word resuming is a really unique framing of that, you know.
Is a unique framing of that.
Yeah. Like I
Yeah, it's like we've left it and we're just resuming it. Yeah. Yeah. So the path is the goal is a very kind of ordinary way to view what we're doing. So this also has an element of working with what we call spiritual materialism. This has an element of that, understanding the path is the goal. Because spiritual materialism is all about trying to get something else and acquire it, so as though we're missing something, or as though there's something that we could just purchase or get, acquire, that then would give us a credential that would make us feel better, or that would cure our problems, or would bring about enlightenment. So this statement of the path is the goal is also a kind of cutting through of spiritual materialism, because it's saying that actually, you know, it doesn't get any better than this. This is it. You've got it already. There's no better. It's the path is it. What you're doing right now is it. And if you don't do this, if you don't relate with your mind, there is no journey. There is no other way to actually realize enlightenment other than to simply relate with what's happening now. So that brings me to one other little amazing reading from Suzuki Roshi. He just has all these pithy things. That's why I quote him a lot. This is a wonderful book called To Shine One Corner of the World. It's students' encounters with Suzuki Roshi. So they're just short little, each page has an encounter of some student, what's happened with one student with Suzuki Roshi, or maybe a group of students. So in this case, it says, one morning in the Zendo, that's where they practice, as we were all silently sitting zazen, Suzuki Roshi said, don't move, just die over and over. Don't anticipate. Nothing can save you now because this is your last moment. Not even enlightenment will help you now because you have no other moments. With no future, be true to yourself and don't move. So, to me, that's a pith instruction on meditation practice. And of course, this statement is somewhat, provocative. Don't move, just die over and over. So this is actually something that we say in Buddhism, that you have to die to the last moment so that you can be present to the new moment. You have to allow it to go, which is a kind of dying. Each moment is gone. It dies, and then you're here again for the next moment. But if you're holding on to what just happened, then you're not actually here. So it's always a matter of giving in, of letting go. Let him be.
What do you think that he emphasized, don't move? Why is that important?
Well, of course, in Zen, one of the main aspects of their technique is an emphasis on not moving. So there's a further sort of a form there that they practice. And I've practiced that. It's quite powerful. And it's good to do it for like short periods of time in your own practice. Just to literally not move a muscle. And then just see what impulse, when impulses to move come up, just notice them. And it's a very potent way to see how you know, all the frivolity that comes up, you really want to wriggle out of whatever, you know, you just want to get more comfortable than you are. Even if you're not uncomfortable, you just are looking for something else, usually. And so there's always this feeling of kind of of a slight movement happening. So if you resign yourself to not moving, it's very, very potent to do that. Yeah, very powerful. Now I had another tack to go after that, and I'm trying to think what it was. I had just before I read that, and now I've forgotten it. Let's see.
Maybe the goal changed.
The goal, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So any thoughts on this? We could just discuss this idea of that the path is really the important thing and not the goal. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Yeah, there is one more important piece to this, which is that, of course, what brings us to the practice is the desire, we could say, to wake up. We could call it the desire for enlightenment, which is a kind of goal. That's why we're here. Why would we be here otherwise if we didn't think something good came of it? So naturally, there is one really appropriate goal in this practice. And that goal is the desire for enlightenment. Now, the interesting thing is pointed out in what Suzuki Roshi just said, is that when we're practicing, of course, that doesn't help you. That desire for enlightenment doesn't help you at all. It's just a concept, it's just a thought at that point. But to get you into the practice, to get you to sit, that's a big motivation. And we need that. That's the one motivation that you don't give up, as it's said. I've heard more than one teacher say this, you know, that you need to keep that motivation to actually attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Because until you attain enlightenment, you're still confused. And so the way to really most be of benefit to yourself and others is to be free from confusion completely, so that you could really be of great benefit. So it's to everyone's benefit for you to kind of get, you know, to go beyond our ignorance.
Is that a decent
confusion.
Understanding or interpretation of what enlightenment means in this tradition?
What?
Free of confusion?
Well, that's one way of talking about it. Free of ignorance, free from confusion. It's many ways of talking about enlightenment. You could say the union of wisdom and compassion. That's another way of saying it. The union of bliss and emptiness. That's another way of saying it. Complete freedom from habitual mind. That's another way of saying it. Master warriorship, that's another way of saying it. Many, many ways. The thing is, the perspective, you know, when you talk about enlightenment, you're always talking about it from a perspective. And because from the point of view of enlightenment, there's no such thing as enlightenment. Enlightenment is just things as they are. What's that? Why do you call it something? Why do you call things as they are something? No point. So there's really, it's only from the perspective of not being enlightened that we call it enlightenment. It's very interesting. Or that it even exists as a concept.
Yeah, it can't be another box, otherwise you're
right.
Trapped inside that.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
I had a couple mornings ago, I woke up and I was really tired. I was supposed to go on a big long hike and I was feeling a little funky, but I sat anyway. And in the process of just sitting and watching the funkiness and the tiredness, I arrived at this state that I can only describe as like intelligent disorientation, where there were like no, there was nothing that I realized that was familiar in my life, but I felt aware in it. And I was there for like maybe 2.5 hours or so, and until I realized, oh, I was trying to hold on to that. And you know, it became just like another kind of a thing.
Right.
That I was like, this is cool.
Right.
But in holding on to it,
or in holding on to it, you could say that you were trying to recapture it.
And I wasn't being present in the moment.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So usually, you know, the way that wakefulness happens to us is in tiny moments, glimpses, tiny, just an instantaneous glimpse. Because where we are fundamentally ourselves, whatever that is, and that's things as they are, isn't it? We are part of things as they are. So we are. There's never a moment when we couldn't connect with the absolute nature of things, right? There's never a moment when we couldn't.
Right.
So consequently, when there's a moment that we just lose track of our ego, lose track of our agenda, lose track of our habit, lose track of our goal, for sometimes for short, brief moments, we're just simply present. And then the next moment, we might realize that we are present. And then we go, oh, that was it. We're like start salivating, you know? How do I get that back? How do I capture that?
But at least you recognize that it exists. And that becomes kind of like, ah.
That's right. Now, this is why it's so important to practice every day, or, you know, most days, as much as you can. Because very quickly, you tend to conceptualize that experience. It becomes a memory. And then it becomes a conceptualized memory, rather than just an actual visceral memory of something that happened. Then it becomes your own version of something that happened. And then it's really two steps divorced. You know, the moment after it happens, that's one step divorced. We call that first thought. The moment after it happens, first thought, best thought. That's one of the sayings of Chögyam Trungpa. First thought, best thought. That means the moment after you're totally just present, and that there's some idea of doing something, that moment is completely fresh and creative. Because it's totally only conditioned by having been totally present. Mm-hmm. So it's a moment that arises out of being totally in contact with your world. So it's a real kind of vivid and accurate thing to do, the first thought. If it is the first thought. So first thought is very fresh. But what we're talking about here is second thought, third thought, fourth thought. And those become old and conceptualized, and they become habitual at some point. So especially as meditators, we have habitual patterns around being meditators that we've developed. You know, our habitual likes and dislikes about the practice, about the people, about the tradition, you know, that we end up having our habitual world that we create here as well. But, you know, it's kind of designed here to cut through that. You know, the community is supposed to be designed that if you're really doing practice, study, and relating with community, that those three things are supposed to kind of undermine the ability to get stuck and turn it into another habit. That's the whole point of what we call taking refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, is that it gets you into a situation where it's very difficult to make a new ego out of it. That's the whole point. So what do you think about, it's very interesting, the notion of course, we need goals in our life, don't we? Without goals, you couldn't really accomplish anything. You have to have a goal. So it's interesting, this relationship between having goals and yet moment by moment not having goals.
This raises a bit of a question for me. Like, mm-hmm. if you had one of those moments where you really touched something special, and then you put it on your trophy shelf and polish it and do all that stuff, but I mean, I understand that that's not helpful. But at the same time, does it seem like you should just forget it, that it never happened, or can you mm-hmm. have some kind of a relationship to that experience?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, exactly. Yeah. It depends where you are, actually, in your relationship with the path and your own path. Because you know, those experiences are also inspiration. So that they're very valuable in a way. Moments of waking up are very valuable. But in what way are they valuable? Because they point us towards how to do that, how to actually be in the moment. That's the value of them. The value, there's no other value of them other than helping you to know how to wake up or what waking up is. So therefore, if we turn it into something other than that, it's kind of missing the point of it. And it actually might obscure our relationship with that experience. In other words, we might try to turn it into a credential, which it happens all the time. You know, people have authentic experiences that you could say are very naked and very insightful. But then they write a book about it, and then they have to defend that view, and then they come up with all kinds of elaborations on it. They make a living out of it. Once you're making a living out of it, you have all kinds of anxieties about making your living, right? So it's like an endless thing that gets built up called samsara. You're kind of making that into another aspect of samsara. So how do you keep it pure is the question. Now, that's what we're really interested in, keeping practice pure and not turning it into yet another kind of way of handle, creating another handle to make ourselves feel like you know, I'm okay in a secure, trying to secure ourselves and our egos again. So, so that's a really good question. I think that, for instance, we have a suggestion in, like, when people are doing retreats or when they're doing Shabbat training levels or any intensive sitting practice, that they not journal. You know, especially during sitting. Needless to say, during sitting, you don't stop. You go, "Oh, that's a great insight. I gotta write that down. I gotta remember that so I can think about it more later." You know, I'm just gonna forget it otherwise. And I mean, think of all the great, brilliant things you've forgotten in meditation. I mean, it's true that you really do, but you don't do that because that then is not actually touch and go. You're not letting it go, which is what meditation is about. So. We actually say to people, you know, because many people, that's a big part of their practice, is journaling, which in a way is capturing your experience in words. Now, on the other hand, as a practice in and of itself, journaling may be a very, very useful practice. In other words, it's its own practice. And so by itself, journaling, sure. But, you know, in relation to meditation practice, journaling, no. So this kind of reminds me of that great little aphorism. The guy goes to his priest and says, "Is it okay if I smoke while I pray?" And the priest said, "Absolutely not." He said, "Well, is it okay if I pray while I smoke?" That sounds a little better. And the priest had to think about that. Well, of course it is, yes. So it's kind of the, you know, yeah, it's the context, isn't it?
Well, for me, this thing, the path is the goal. I bring it into my, I was going to use the word my ambition. It's very funny that you said that. Which, you know, eventually is to be able to bring some of this into the work that I do, which is coaching leaders and organizations. And, you know, of course, I have to understand it myself first. So it's wild that I would be able to get there. But the thing that's so hard for me to think about talking to them about is that generally, and most of us who work in organizations or any kind of work, you're evaluated by your ability to set a goal and reach it. Not only that, but by your ability to predict what the goal should actually be based on market forces and blah, 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 right? And so to say to people, well, yes, sure, and you have to be here and in the experience you're having now, you might want to consider that because that's the only experience you have. And it's just so counterintuitive to the environment that they're living in. And so the simpler you can make it, for me it seems like the better. That's why some of what you said, which I had to write down and capture.
We believe in taking notes around here.
Yeah. It's a whole different thing.
It's right? Different than when you're meditating.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah. But you know, what you said just popped something into my mind, which is that the whole notion of, for instance, justice in our society is the notion that you can arrive at it through an adversarial way, which is totally about aggression, right. You know, and it's about kind of fighting and see who wins. So it's all about ambition, it's all about who's better, and then suppose that you're going to arrive at the truth.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So right there, I think there's a big flaw. But at the same time, you know, I have many friends who are lawyers in our community. There are many lawyers within our community, mm-hmm. and who practice a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think that what begins to happen is that the culture, you know, you realize that you're not in an enlightened culture when you're in the law office.
Right.
You know, it's its own culture, isn't it? And so you're an ambassador. You're living in two cultures. You're living in the meditative culture or enlightened culture, and then you're also living in this other culture, which is not those doesn't necessarily have those values at all. And so it's just like going to another country, you know? You're kind of, you don't, you know, Trungpa Trungpa had this amazing saying. He said, when in Rome, do as you do at home. I love that. When in Rome, do as you do at home. So basically you have to be yourself, but at the same time you have to respect that there's another culture here. And so there's a dance that happens there, isn't there? That you, on the one hand, yeah, you have to play the game, like if you're in school. There's a particular game mm-hmm. that you have to play. Mm-hmm. And it's about, you know, doing assignments, it's about pleasing the teacher, you know, figuring out what the teacher likes and doing it. You know, there's a lot of elements to that particular game. Well, that's how you get the grades, is you
right.
do the assignments, you do the papers, you figure out what does this professor really want. And you try to give them what, you know, I mean, that's very manipulative, but that's what most students try to do. You know, you kind of try to work it so that, you know, I mean, you might write a brilliant paper that completely insults the professor, and you don't want to do that. So you do have to kind of work within the bounds of what the local culture is, what the belief system is. So this is very interesting, and I think that what the advantage you have as a meditator is that you develop a very sharp intelligence as a meditator and a tremendous sense of vulnerability, so that you're actually able to do both. You're able to have moments where you just drop it and be, and then moments where you remember what the game is that you're playing. And you, therefore, because you have that moment of freshness, you can play it better, actually. You actually can. You can really appreciate the game as a game. Whereas other people might be caught in the game. They forget it's a game. And then it creates tremendous anxiety.
Yeah, so you can bring your equanimity, like, from meditation practice to the experience of... there's many experiences. I mean, there's, like, having set a goal and then missing it. Having set a goal and hitting it, and that's great. Having set a goal, hitting it, and realizing that the price you gave was too much. You know, all those things, you know.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can take that as the opportunity to go crazy. Or you can sit, hold your seat, and take it as part of the richness of your human experience. I'm trying not to go crazy.
Yes. Well, it's really the meat in your sandwich.
Yeah.
The meat in your sandwich is that your buttons are being pushed out in the world.
Yeah.
You know, people aren't particularly being compassionate. They're trying to get what they want, and you might be in the way. Mm-hmm. Or you might be one way for them to get it, or you might be in the way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of things going on there that create a lot of projections and a lot of potential confusion. But it's very, very rich.
Driving alone is very aggressive and talk about trying to be contemplative and practice awareness when you drive is very
contemplative.
It really pushes your buttons.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great story about in Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism by Trungpa Trungpa, about a yogi who decides to go into life retreat. You know, so he's going to spend the rest of his life in a cave. And this is something that was traditional in Tibet. Some people decided to do that. And the Chinese decided to invade. And so they went and had to get him out of the cave because they didn't want him to be killed by the Chinese. So they got him out of the cave, and he had been, I don't know how long he'd been in there, but for some time. And then in talking with him later, he said, you know, I really progressed a lot after you took me out of the cave. That's really when I began to really progress on the path. And this is the interesting thing, you know. It's said that our tradition is a yogic tradition. From a Buddhist point of view, this is a yogic tradition. That means you're in the world. You're not a monastic. You're not in a, you don't leave the world and go into a monastery. You're in the world. And according to Trungpa Trungpa, the yogic path is considered the fast path to enlightenment. Because you're in the world, you have to have much greater discipline as to actually be a contemplative in the world than to leave the world. And because you have so much more discipline and your buttons are being pushed all the time, you get to work with all of your confusion and what we call kleshas, all of your kind of confused tendencies get triggered all the time. And you have to get to work with them. Whereas if you're alone in a cave, you know, well, it might not get triggered at all. So in a way, this is a very fortunate thing that you're in a situation where people are expressing their anger and their passion and their this passion, aggression, and ignorance at you. And then you actually get to see what it provokes in you. And then you get to work with that. And that's fabulous. Fabulous acceleration of your path. Same thing as being in a relationship, you know. It accelerates your path greatly as well.
I heard just the other night related to that. I think it was a poem somebody was reading. I'll just paraphrase it. The world is like a grindstone. It'll either grind you to bits or turn you into something beautiful. The choice is yours.
Can you say that again, please?
The world is like a grindstone. It'll either grind you to bits or turn you into something beautiful, and the choice is yours.
Mm-hmm. It's this. There's an aspect in Buddhism of right livelihood, which is. Mm-hmm. Just talk about that for a second.
Yeah, right livelihood. Well, there's the Eightfold Path, it's called. Mm-hmm. Gee, I don't know, maybe between us all we could remember the Eightfold Path. It's not something we study very much in our community.
Right speech and right...
Right, there's right livelihood, right speech,
view,
intention. I actually don't remember them, but there's eight of them. Eightfold Path. And right meditation is one of them.
Right thinking.
Maybe. Yeah, I can't remember. But anyway, right livelihood is a livelihood that doesn't cause harm. So for instance, as a Buddhist, probably one wouldn't, you know, be a chef who has to cook lobsters. You'd have to kill sentient beings with your own hands and that. You can't do that as a Buddhist. And also something, you know, fishing, be a fisherman, mm-hmm. or a hunter. Those are not right livelihoods for a Buddhist practitioner.
But yet, not everyone in this sangha is a vegetarian, correct?
That's
people
right.
Chicken, people eat.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's
in
right.
In fact, that's a very interesting point, is that Tibet, with its rich, rich Buddhist culture, couldn't be vegetarian. Just ecologically, it was not possible.
Right.
You know, and so they had to eat meat, and I presume they had people who were employed as butchers.
Well, no, actually, no, they didn't.
Okay.
They had, not Tibetans, they had Muslims who did the butchering and did the,
That's
how it worked. Yeah, it is. It is, I know. Well, you know, the way it's explained is, you know, the Buddha even received meat in his begging bowl. You know, the Buddha wasn't particularly specifically a vegetarian in the sense that whatever you were given, you would eat. And if his last meal, in fact, was wild boar, a kind of boar. But but the idea there is you don't ask someone to kill it for you. If it's offered, you can receive it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the notion. So mm-hmm. it's based on this idea that you're begging for food, mm-hmm. and which is how it was done originally. And so whatever you receive, it would be improper to send it back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you accept it as generosity. There's even, well, I won't go there. There's some interesting stories around that. But, yeah, so.
Even people that are vegetarians are still doing harm. Like the Jains in India will sweep the sidewalk permanent, so they'll step on a body
where
yeah. Well, I remember Kala Rinpoche, who was a great teacher in the West, was talking about that maybe one of the first jet flights he ever took, jet plane flights, you know? And they flew over, you know, farmland and stuff, and maybe it wasn't a jet, maybe it was a prop plane, I don't know, but he saw them, you know, spraying and doing the things that they do, and he said, you know, there's maybe even more killing in eating vegetables than there is in eating meat, because when they till the soil, they're killing all those worms and all those insects, and when you harvest, and then if you're spraying, you're killing them, there's just endless killing that seems to happen to stay alive, to be, and then of course every breath we take, we are killing microorganisms in our bodies, you know. So there's some kind of notion here that to be alive in this situation, there's a certain amount of killing that happens. The idea, though, is that we're not doing it purposefully. It's doing it with our own two hands as Buddhists. When we take refuge and become a Buddhist, that's one of the vows we take, is not to kill something with our own hands. So there's this idea that you wouldn't ask someone to kill it for you either. It's supposed to be at least two hands removed. So, yeah.
Which makes it, with grocery stores, it's very good.
Well, that's right. But, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, Trungpa Trungpa did say there's too much meat here. Too much killing. Yeah. And I personally love every now and then a big steak, you know.
Yeah.
I know it's not quite right. But he said, you know, ideally we would eat elephants.
Huh?
Ideally we would eat elephants because there's less killing. One elephant could feed a lot more people. And Buddhists generally don't eat, like, they wouldn't eat shrimp, because you have to kill, like, 30 of them to have a meal, or however many, maybe less, I don't know. I don't eat shrimp, so...
Whales, elephants.
Yeah, right. Ideally, you would eat big animals, so you'd kill less of them. But there's no real sort of logic that makes it really work neatly. It's kind of...
Well, it is kind of interesting, yeah. Because, of course... There is a natural cycle of life and death. So, you know, it's kind of hard to, I mean, you know, if a tiger is going to eat, it's going to kill another mammal. And we're a mammal and we kill other mammals.
It's hard to live outside that
Well,
cycle.
As a Buddhist, when you really take that vow
and
become a Buddhist
formally,
There's a notion there that we are not going to reject sentient beings, that we are going to help sentient beings. So killing is like the ultimate rejection of a sentient being, especially if you do it with aggression. And so, obviously, there are extraordinary times when you have to kill something for the benefit of others. You know, there are all kinds of stories about that. But the karma in it is such that it does not help your path, and it doesn't help the other person's path particularly. So it's something we don't do if possible. When possible, we don't do it. But eating meat or not eating meat, most Buddhists, like Mahayana Buddhists, are vegetarians. Most of them pretty much are vegetarians. And Tibetan Buddhists aren't vegetarians generally, unless they've decided to be, like the Dalai Lama has now decided to be a vegetarian.
And the Karmapa is also.
Karmapa is also vegetarian,
So I guess actually though, wouldn't it seem true that if you're being mindful and you're killing an animal to eat it, you're being aware of the karma that you're creating for yourself, and in some sense probably that's not okay, but it's being done mindfully, I guess.
Well, the Buddha said it's if you're enlightened, you're incapable of doing that.
Oh, really?
You wouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah.
Because you're so mindful, you would not be able to take that life.
That
you couldn't do it. I mean, there's an amazing scene.
Intense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an amazing scene in a movie. Can't remember the name. It's an amazing movie. It takes place on like the plains between Russia and China,
Mongolia,
that area, and there's these what do they call the wandering nomads, nomad family, which are like really Mongolian Buddhists. So they are Buddhists, but they are herdsmen. I mean, that's how they live, and they also live on. You have to kill meat for meat. So there's a special kind of thing, way that they relate with Buddhism, to be able to do that. But there's an actual scene where he does it. It's an amazing thing in the movie where he actually takes one goat and and just cuts, I can't remember, he cuts a tiny, tiny slit somewhere in the goat's throat, and then just holds the goat. He hugs it. He actually holds it.
Comforts it.
And, well, I don't know that he's comforting it. He's killing it.
Okay.
But he's killing it with his whole body, and it's a really amazing scene. And the goat at first struggles, but then, you know, just slowly dies. It's quite intense.
Yeah.
It's an intense movie.
Is this a documentary?
No, it's a movie, but it's done with real people from that area. And I think it was something Eden, Close to Eden or something like that. It's a fabulous movie. But I once heard one Buddhist teacher say there are sometimes extraordinary circumstances where you have to kill. And he said, in that case, if you're a Buddhist, you need to be trained to be able to liberate that person. Mm-hmm. If you can liberate them, then it's different. Mm-hmm. If you can't liberate them, then you're just killing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting thing to think about.
What about every time we drive a car and we're putting more carbon into the atmosphere and we're killing the earth and killing, it goes bigger than
It does.
Yeah.
And I think that our whole culture is going to have to change in order to survive and not destroy the earth. But we're not quite at the point where everyone gets it. In fact, even some of us don't fully get it yet. I mean, look at, there are people who are fighting for the environment and flying all over the world doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're one of the biggest users of carbon are the people in planes. So there's lots of paradoxes here.
Mm-hmm. But which means it's true.
Right?
Which means it's true, yeah. So really we need to just keep going, keep practicing. And the path is the goal means that if we keep practicing the path, we start to understand how to properly relate with goals. That's part of it too.
Mm-hmm.
That we do have to have goals in our life, but if we really relate with the path, then we start to see the goals in perspective and have a sane relationship with them, I think.
Yeah, I was talking to, what's the archery called again?
Kudo.
Kudo. Talking to a Kudo master in one of the levels. And, he was talking about how the goal isn't really to hit the target.
That's right.
And I said this to a friend of mine who's not a practitioner. He was like, what the hell? That doesn't make any sense at all. Big sporto, boulder, climb every mountain with the bike,
I actually studied with Shibata Sensei for a while, and he would always say, Kudo is not a sport.
Right.
He said, it's about mind. It's about the mind. It's not a sport.
Yeah.
He said, he'd always say, target doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That's why when you're learning Kudo, you're standing 2 feet away from the bale of hay. 2 feet away. You can't miss it. Later on, they put a target out there.
Yeah.
Then it's even more interesting.
Yeah.
It's even more interesting. So it's like a mirror to the target's like a mirror to your mind.
Someone should write a book about contemplative golf.
It's been written. Golf in the Kingdom.
Oh, really?
It's a very old book, yeah.
I think contemplative driving.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
That's
huh?
a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a book I should write.
There you go. while you're driving,
It
has to be an electric car.
Or standing in line at the grocery. These are times when it's so easy to notice how much other people are in your way.
Yeah, it's also very interesting though if you've been practicing all day, like in a Shambhala training situation. That generally there's a more of a gap there when those situations happen, generally speaking.
Yeah.
That you don't immediately jump and get angry. You actually have a moment where you kind of, But then,
For driving after being on a retreat for a month.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it?
I would get in the car and I would feel like, oh, I'm going really, really fast and there's cars behind me getting really irritated. And I look at the speedometer and go, oh, I'm only going 35. And they're going, they're trying to go 50 in it. But I felt I was going really fast.
Yeah.
So I started going fast. I'm sorry. But everything slows down so much that you feel like you're going fast.
Yeah, there's definitely a big re-entry period after re-entry.
Yeah, so I was irritating them unintentionally.
Yeah. Well, I think we can be very irritating, Buddhists.
Yes.
We can be very, very irritating to the rest of the world. And maybe it's a good irritation. So it's a time.
There is a book about driving Zen in the Art of Guidance.
Oh, there is one?
Oh, wow.
Well, there could always be more.
Is it for race car drivers? No. Okay. So we dedicate the merit. Do we have copies of this somewhere, usually?
In the shrine.
Oh, it's in the box? I forget it.
Yeah.
All right. So if you don't know it, you could just listen, okay? We're going to do what's called dedicate the merit. And the idea here is that when you discuss the Dharma, great merit is generated, and merit is easily destroyed if we just keep it for ourselves. But when we dedicate it to others, it becomes indestructible and much greater. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, by the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom, may the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Yeah.